Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm really happy to be talking to Dr. W. Keith Campbell. Firstly, Keith, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Alex. Appreciate it.
I was just saying to Keith before we started recording that I don't think you can do a relationship conference in 2021 and not talk about the issue we're going to talk about today, which is the issue of narcissism and how it can show up in different ways, but particularly in the context of relationship. And some of the ways that we can spot that in others, I guess in ourselves, if I'm not sure how much narcissists reflect on these things, but reflect in themselves. And also some of the ways we can navigate some of the challenges that can come up with narcissists in our lives. Just to give people a bit of Keith's background, Dr. W. Keith Campbell is a professor of psychology at the University of Georgia. He's the author of The Narcissism Epidemic, When You Love a Man Who Loves Himself. It's a great title, by the way. And his most recent book, The New Science of Narcissism, Understanding One of the Greatest Psychological Challenges of Our Time and What You Can Do About It. He's also the author of more than 120 peer-reviewed articles. And Dr. Campbell lives in Athens in Georgia. So Keith, I think perhaps just in a kind of set a bit of frame around this, when we talk about narcissism or someone being a narcissist, what do we actually mean by that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it is more complicated than it sounds. So when people use the term narcissism, they're usually talking about somebody with an inflated ego, some self-enhancement, think they're better than they are, a sense of entitlement. But often people use it just to mean jerk, because they don't know what it means, but it sounds bad. It's a narcissistic jerk. But it really has a very technical meaning, and there's a few different faces of this technical meaning that are important to talk about. So when we're talking about narcissism, we can talk about two forms that are pretty common. One, which is what most people think about, is grandiose narcissism. So this is a combination of sort of self-importance and energy and maybe some charisma and extroversion, but also antagonism, a sense of entitlement, a sense of self-importance. I sometimes think about it as sort of energized or weaponized antagonism or meanness. And so this more grandiose style of narcissism is really useful if you want to be a politician or you want to be a boss or you want to date a bunch of people or whatever. It's because it's very good at starting relationships. And then on the other side, you have what we call vulnerable narcissism. So this, you take that same self-importance, I matter, you know, I deserve special treatment, but I'm also a little insecure. I'm worried I don't get the attention I deserve. I have low self-esteem. I'm fearful meeting people. So it's a very different face of narcissism. It's a much more defensive side. So you have this more defensive, vulnerable face and this more aggressive, you know, confident, grandiose face of narcissism. And the more vulnerable folks end up in clinical settings a lot. So they'll end up seeing a psychologist or psychiatrist because they're a little depressed. What happens then when this narcissism gets extreme? So you become so narcissistic, it starts damaging your relationships, it damages your ability to work effectively, you become a CEO and take too many risks, whatever the case is, it can become a clinical disorder, which is narcissistic personality disorder, which is relatively rare, maybe 1 or 2% of the population. And it's primarily grandiose, but also has some vulnerability in it. So to bring that all back, when somebody uses the term narcissism, they could be talking about a personality of somebody who's really confident, but a little bit mean and self-centered, you know, Iron Man, Tony Stark, kind of like the guy, but he's a jerk. Or they could be talking about somebody who's a little neurotic and, you know, insecure and always wants attention, is really defensive. There's Keith. You can't tell him anything. He's always defensive. That's the more vulnerable narcissism. Or you could talk about somebody with a full-blown psychiatric disorder. And that could be narcissism as well. So there's really these three different definitions people are using.
And is one way to think about it that there's sort of a spectrum, right? And there are people which are categorically are going to meet diagnostic criteria for narcissist personality disorder, and others that are not going to meet that, but there's characteristics. Is that
absolutely? So it is, narcissism falls on a spectrum or a continuum, just like most personality traits or personality disorders. So what happens is, you know, it's like you know, in the U.S., we have, you know, we play basketball. Well, you find these people who play basketball that are athletic and 7 feet tall. And you go, those aren't humans. Those are monsters. No, they're human. They're just on the end of the continuum that happen to be great athletes. Same with narcissism. You go, that person's so self-absorbed. They're not getting it at all. They're ruining their life because of it. They're different. No, it's the same continuum. What happens with our personality is most of us have a personality, but we're able to turn it on and off. You know, when I'm on doing a podcast, I might be really extroverted because I'm trying to get some emotion into my voice. But if I'm reading or quiet, I'm not doing that. So we're able to do that. What happens if your personality becomes fixed and, you know, you can't change it? It can be really damaging. So if you're narcissistic at work, you're narcissistic on the air, you're narcissistic with your small children, it becomes a disorder. Yes. But if you can just be narcissistic when you're on the stage or at the club and not at home with your wife and kids, it's not a disorder. It's more of a trait.
Right. Right. And as you say, that there can be useful aspects to be able to become that character. What's dangerous is becoming identified with being that character.
Yes. Believe in your own hype. I mean, having a narcissistic persona, as anybody in the audience can probably see, is good at meeting people at clubs. It's good at public speaking. It's good for being a leader. People like narcissistic leaders. They like narcissistic celebrities and politicians. So it has all these benefits, which is why it's people are drawn to narcissism, but it has these costs as well. The costs are it's hard to form close relationships with people, and the people who want to have close relationships with you don't get them.
Are there some examples that you can give of people in history who you know would likely meet the criteria of what we're talking about here?
You know, I get asked that question a lot, and I have two answers. And one is, you know, you can think about people, and it's typically people in politics who come across as very narcissistic. So, you know, Donald Trump, sort of very narcissistic, expressive character. We had another governor in New York, Cuomo, who just resigned because he was very narcissistic as well. And, you know, you say ethical lapses, infidelity, you know, sexual harassment, you get a lot of negative stuff. So those are more political types. You know, the characters are harder because there's no one watches all the same movies anymore. But I always like Iron Man, Tony Stark in the Marvel movies is kind of a very likable narcissistic leader character because he has all that extroversion and confidence and messes people up. There's a new show on Amazon Prime with a narcissistic superhero that was both grandiose and honorable. So there's different versions out there. The court case for Theranos trial right now, with Elizabeth Holmes, who started a company as a CEO, has a lot of talk about narcissism with that case. You see it in the news all the time.
In a sense, it's when someone is overly invested in and pleased with their own public image and their persona, that's often a sign from what you're saying.
Yeah, it's coming across with this sort of deep confidence, and often people who are very narcissistic.
You got a canine friend that wants to contribute.
Yeah, I'm gonna just run sick. Stop it. I'm just gonna talk through this and I apologize.
That's fine.
Because we also have to run out of the room. What happens with narcissism, it's very good for becoming a leader because you have confidence and vision. You go, I can do it. I'm the one, I'm the only one who can do it. And when people are scared, they go, I'm going to look at Keith because he seems confident. So narcissism is a really good trait in becoming a leader. The technical term we use is emergent leadership, but it's very good for this. So entrepreneurship is filled with narcissistic characters. A lot of early stage leadership. This isn't a broad brush, like all leaders or anything like that. It's just a good place to attract narcissists because they're like, I have an opportunity to get power and control over people. This is a place to do it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a good pathway for narcissism.
And how much is a narcissist able to self-reflect and to recognize that they have some or a lot of these qualities?
So, you know, the old idea, was that there was no self-awareness. You're narcissistic. You just didn't get it at all. You're just oblivious. But in the research, what we find, and I've talked to a lot of narcissistic individuals about it as well, and there does seem to be awareness with people. Often what I hear people say, and this is, again, what we see in the research, is I know my ego helps me at work, but I see other people with close, loving relationships, and I don't have those. And I want those close, loving relationships, but I know my ego is interfering with it. So that's one area where I see people's self-awareness. The other time you see it is when they fail and they start pointing fingers. So you can look at these different, you know, look at these different sort of failed political leaders or business leaders. And very rarely they say, you know what, I just screwed up because I'm just an arrogant jerk and I really feel bad and I'm going to be a more loving person. Instead, what they say is, you know what, you're just mad at me because I'm kind of Italian and just like to kiss girls. That's just, you're just hating on me for who I am. Or they're saying, you're hating me because I had a successful business, but you were just jealous and you're taking me out, or whatever the case is. So it's very hard for people in narcissistic state, you know, I'm just kind of not as good as I think.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the problem comes in.
And what's the research on where narcissism come from? How much of it is genetic? How much of it is kind of conditioning, or, you know, how much is nature nurture?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And we have a lot of good data now on the heritability of personality, including narcissism. We find about 50%, you know, give or take, I'm using these terms a little bit loosely, but about 50% is inherited, probably genetic. There is no single or pair of narcissistic genes out there we're going to find. I promise at this point, it's a lot of genes involved that we don't really understand, but we know about half of it's inherited or heritable from parents. 1% of that is just kind of what we call non-shared environment. You're growing up and maybe you meet a certain group of friends that treat you one way, or you have an opportunity or you don't have an opportunity or something happens. And then about 20% is parenting. So the parenting piece is much smaller than most people think. Most people like, yeah, I'm a parent, I can control my kids. You really can't that much. But what we find with the parenting in narcissism is more grandiose narcissists report that their parents put them on a pedestal, treated them as a special child. They're kind of a trophy kid. And with the more vulnerable narcissists, their parents, they describe as more cold and abusive and controlling, like you see with a lot of disorders. But again, the parenting isn't the big piece. A lot of it is genetics and just random luck, just what happens.
It is part of it that that one is born a narcissist, but how their parentage shapes the type of narcissist they become?
That's a very interesting question. And I don't have an answer to it, but I don't have an answer that's really grounded in science. What I would speculate is, yes, you can do both. So you can have a case where you have somebody who's got all the wiring to be really grandiose. So they're driven, they're kind of extroverted, and they get traumatized. So you take somebody that's built to be kind of the, you know, the Super Bowl quarterback. It is a terrible example to use in a British show. I apologize for going to US.
Well, our audience is global. You're okay.
Oh, okay. Global audience. I'm like the striker, whatever, you know, you're kind of wired to be the striker, but you've got some early trauma that makes you really defensive. And in when you have cases like that, you can find people that are really grandiose, but also have a lot of that defensiveness, that vulnerability, that you can see both those things in them.
And what's the potential for a narcissist to change? Because this is one of the things that, you know, it's a lot of the what's in the public domain, let's say, is that once a narcissist, always a narcissist.
Yeah.
But is that right? Or is there some evidence that there is, I guess, maybe depending upon where on the spectrum somebody is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm going to say that the short answer is it's wrong. And again, we used to think that people who are narcissistic couldn't change, that there was kind of set in stone. It was very strongly defensive. It seems that they can, and we have data showing this. So here is the challenge. If I think I am better than everybody, I don't really want to change. You know, it has to be something to motivate me to change. So the big challenge with narcissism is getting that I need to change. And then the second big challenge is getting that person into, let's say, psychotherapy and have them stay in therapy. So we have a huge problem with dropout rates in therapy with narcissists. And they'll go, you know, I'm not the problem. It's my wife. Shouldn't have married her. You know, maybe I'll stick with, you know, three marriages next time. And they quit and they don't get any better. But when we actually find people who are narcissistic and stick with therapy, they seem to have the ability to change. And, wow. And the therapy itself doesn't seem to matter. It seems to work with group therapy and dialectic behavioral therapy and more Freudian therapies and more cognitive behavioral therapies. All the therapies seem to have some benefit if the person is willing to stay in therapy and work for it.
That's super interesting because that's quite contrary to the general narrative, right? Yes. But what I think is also super interesting what you're saying.
The one catch to this is I say that and people go, great, I can change my wife. And I'm like, it doesn't mean you can change anybody. So somebody who's narcissistic can change themselves, but the ability for me, Keith, to tell you, Alex, to change is very, very hard. So people, it's a lot like addiction. You know, you're married with somebody who's an addict. You go, the person's like, I don't want to be an addict. And you go, I don't want you to be an addict, but you can't change an addict. Yeah. The addict has to change. And I think narcissism is very similar. So there's some optimism there that there is the possibility of change. I think there's a lot of hope for people who want to change, but I don't have a lot of optimism for people saying, hey, I've got this guy. And other than the narcissism, he's the best husband I could ever want. Can you help me just fine tune him a little bit?
I mean, if you crack that bit, you'll change the world, change history, right?
I'm retiring. Yeah, that's what done. I'm done. But but that's that part is hard. But yeah, the change is definitely possible. I think we're learning a lot that personality can change. It's just a matter of putting the effort in.
Yeah. That's super interesting. I'd love to move a little bit now then to narcissism in relationship. Like, and I think what one of the opening pieces is what are the clues that someone you're in relationship with is a narcissist? What are some of the things that you might find yourself feeling? What are some of the signs that can, because often just to kind of load the question up a bit more, one of the things that can also happen is that narcissists can also attract people that perhaps lack in self-worth or self-esteem and can get pulled in certain dynamics that they're almost normalized to it. So I'm really interested in how someone can recognize that they're in a dynamic like this.
So it's challenging because and this is all based on research, talking to people, everything, probably your own experience. If I meet somebody at a club or at a bar or a restaurant who's more grandiose narcissist, chances are I'm probably going to like the person when I first meet them because they're going to seem a little bit energized and they're going to seem confident. Hey, I'm Keith. Great to meet you. I like that guy. He seems confident, energized, right? So you start dating. And often when you start dating people who are narcissistic, it's exciting and fun. And when we date, you know, the way in the West, a lot of our dating works is you start off with the kind of the fun part, and then you go to the emotional commitment part in 6 months, 6 weeks, whatever. You kind of translate from fun dating to emotional commitment. What happens when you date the narcissist is you have this initial stage, the fun stage, and that can be really fun when you're dating the exciting narcissist because you're going to clubs and they're telling you you're great. And you're like, this person's so energetic and I feel good about my ego. And then in the relationship, when you're supposed to transition to, we're going to talk about meaning and emotional depth and everything, it doesn't happen. So when you notice the narcissism at first, the first red flag is I'm really attracted to this confident person and they're sweeping me off my feet. That's when I always go, I better double check. Let's look at their relationship history. Let's see if they're really this good or maybe there's some wreckage behind them. And then the second time you really see it is when you're making that relationship transition from sort of a more fun dating style relationship to more of an emotionally deep committed relationship, and your narcissistic partner doesn't make that transition with you. And so you see a lot of conflict at that stage. My advice to people, and I hate giving advice, so just take this very loosely because life is complicated, but when you evaluate somebody as a date, you need to get their whole history, not just how they treat you, I'm like, watch how they treat the staff at the restaurant. Watch how they talk about their friends. Look at their past relationships. Were they healthy? You know, they have a healthy set of relationships or not healthy. And that's where you're going to see the stuff, but you're not going to see narcissism talking to the person if they want you to like them. You're going to like the person who's narcissistic. This is why I always vote for these people. And they're all our celebrities because they're likable people.
Yeah. But I think that's a really important piece though, isn't it? Because I think people can sometimes think, oh, narcissists are easy to spot because they're arrogant and they're unlikable. And what you're saying is actually they're often very charming, and that's part of their talent in a sense.
Absolutely. And when you see these narcissistic celebrities or leaders, half the people love them. You go, well, they're such a horrible person. They've got a million people who love them because they have such a big personality and they've convinced half the people to follow them. So it's harder to see than you think. And often, like I said, when I start getting these, God, what a great confident dude, you know, look at that. I'm like, warning sign.
Right. You Interesting.
Know, it's not only what you think. If you meet somebody who's kind of a boorish, over-the-top narcissist, they won't be that attractive, but you don't see that many of them.
And is there something also about the absence or the inability to have empathy, which is a clue in relationship?
Yeah, and that's a really challenging question. And there's been a lot of research on that question of empathy because people use that in two different ways. So one way is empathy is I feel, you know, I see Alex suffering. I feel this warm connection like, man, Alex is suffering. I want him to stop. It's kind of that classic compassion. And then there's another kind of empathy, which is more cognitive perspective taking. Alex is suffering. I can see why he's suffering. You know, I can make him suffer. I can take that suffering away. I understand it. With narcissism, what you find is that there is this ability to perspective take. They can see they're not lacking. They're like, you know, you're crying. They're like, what's Alex doing? What are those tears? I don't understand. They know what's going on. What's missing is that more foundational compassion piece, you know, that more warm love and compassion. You know, so that the potential is somebody who's very narcissistic, they know what's going on. You can train people to sort of see how to act compassionately to people.
One of the other pieces that comes to my mind, and I guess this is probably the case with personality disorders more broadly as well, but the experience of being someone and someone gaslighting, someone causing someone to question their own perspective. And one of the things that can happen when someone's particularly in a long-term relationship with someone that has some form of personality disorder, they can end up really losing their own clarity and their own, the very sort of insight or perspective that's actually going to allow them to get out of that.
So what you find, and this really is something that's somewhat particular to narcissism and not just all disorders, there isn't a lot of research on this, but the idea of gaslighting, it comes from an old movie where, you know, the husband would mess with the lights in the house and then tell the wife, I'm not messing with the lights. And she's like, the lights are going off and basically making somebody crazy. So gaslighting is you know, you don't affirm somebody's sense of reality and makes them crazy. In narcissism, we also find what we call game playing, which is people going like, I love you. No, I don't. Did I say that? I didn't mean that. And so and what happens when you gaslight, you game play, is you get power in the relationship. The other person's uncertain, they're unstable, but you know what's going on. So narcissists will use these strategies, this kind of deception, dishonesty, in order to gain power. They make you kind of unstable and they can control the relationship. And it's something you see. I mean, you see it with psychopathy, you know, any of these really more controlling traits. It's very dark. It's very dark.
And also, I think what can happen is when you have someone whose tendency is that they take responsibility and they have a lot of empathy and a lot of compassion for other people, that I think one can find themselves in relationship with someone who's a narcissist. And in a sense, that empathy and that compassion almost gets weaponized against them. I don't know if that's something you can speak to a little bit, where it's almost like...
Yeah, I can't speak to that. So we, you know, doing a lot of research on narcissism, especially with dating, what you would find is that if I get somebody who's sort of a grandiose narcissist paired with another grandiose narcissist, it seems to work kind of okay. You get two shallow, you know, kind of two shallow people together. They're both a little manipulative. They're both attractive. It can be, it's just, you know, kind of like a shallow celebrity couple. It's like, fine. No one's getting hurt.
It's functionally dysfunctional.
Right. But what happens when you're narcissistic and you find yourself with somebody who's very compassionate, very caring, and maybe somebody like you're hinting at, maybe somebody that had some maybe codependency in their past, maybe an alcoholic relationship in the past, that they're a bit of a caregiver. When you get it, the sort of the exploiting or exploitative narcissist with the caregiver personality, it can get really bad because the caregiver will get sucked into supporting the narcissist, and then the narcissist will take more advantage of the situation because they have control. So they will get worse and worse, and it will spiral in a very bad way. You try to avoid that. Narcissist with narcissist. I mean,
it's like, look,
you guys are both
apps,
perfect
right?
for each other. Great. Just leave the nice people alone, because really, you know, these personalities can do a lot of damage to people who are more trusting, more open, more caring. You know, it's a very toxic thing at times. I'd rather separate them.
Yeah. So if someone's watching this or listening to this and they recognize that they're in a relationship with someone who is a narcissist. And you know, and maybe we can answer this from a few different perspectives. Maybe it's the narcissist where, you know, on that spectrum, it's not so severe this person's completely beyond help. But actually, as you spoke to very eloquently earlier, that sometimes it's almost more dangerous if there's the perception this person maybe can be helped and be changed. But what in that instance, what would your recommendation be? So if you were counseling or working with someone, and it became clear that that was part of what was happening in their relationship, how would you help them to work with that?
You know, there's a lot of issues with relationships, and a big one is how committed and connected you are. So if you've got kids, you've got something that's worth working for. If my daughter were dating somebody like this, I'd just say, get the hell out. Don't look back. Forget it. Get a U-Haul, leave a note. You know, it's just not worth your time. But if you're in a relationship and it's somebody like, yeah, they're a good dad and they work, but they're arrogant. And that's when you sort of get into therapy. But the first thing you do is you protect yourself. You know, you build because what happens is you get in these debates with somebody who's narcissistic and they're going to test your sense of reality. A lot like we were talking about with gaslighting. So what you need is a support network of people that can say, Alex, we know the truth. This is the truth. You're getting off course again. Trust us. We're watching this. So you need a support network. If it's legal, you need a legal team. And hopefully you're not at that point, but you really need to protect yourself. And once you're protected, you figure out what to do. And often I don't suggest talking to somebody saying, hey, you're kind of a narcissist. Why don't you be less of one? What I suggest doing is saying, God, you're doing so great. But I think if you would spend more time with the kids, that would be really great for them, and you would be even a better father. And then you would reward people for spending time with the kids. I mean, it's more simple than trying to attack a whole person. It's more so often what we see with narcissism is there's that lack of empathy or warmth or communion. And if you can get that in there, it can take care of a lot of the problems with narcissism.
Interesting. So you're actually not necessarily calling out the core issue in a direct and blatant way.
Yeah, because you're going to get a lot of defensiveness. And the problem is you probably marry this person because there's something you like. Maybe she was really cute and attractive. And so you're like, I kind of like that part of you. I like the fact that you care about how you look. I just wish you would be nice sometimes to the dog. You know, and you can kind of work, you can try to work on those things. One way to think about it is if you're narcissistic, what matters to you is status. You know, I want social status. I want power. I want people to think I'm cool. So if I can connect being a good person with social status or people thinking you're a good person or a popular, powerful person, that might help. So if I can get you to believe that, you know, if I'm loving to my kids, that will make me more popular. and more high in status, that might help with the narcissism.
So in a sense, rather than going down the perhaps quite tempting path of character assassination, in a sense, what you're doing is you're looking for the resultant behaviors and trying to reshape some of those.
Very much. And in a context where you are protected first.
Yes.
You know, protect your self first and then try to work on the edges of things, shifting the person rather than trying to do psychotherapy. I mean, you know, that's very hard, but moving people in that direction. We live in a weird time where money's free. And so you people, you know, everybody can be rich. You just, the problem is, but not everybody can have a loving family. And so you can be really narcissistic. You're like, yeah, you're rich and you're good looking, but you don't even have a family. You're kind of a loser.
Right.
And that can be motivating to people to say, you know, I need some love. I need some connection. And ego isn't enough to live on.
Yeah, it's almost what I guess what you're doing is you're pointing in a tactful, careful way to the flaws in the narcissism and helping them see how they can get closer to the image they're trying to be.
Right. And as long as you can, I mean, this isn't easy, but as long as you can align those two things, the narcissist's desire to be popular and special and good, and your desire for the narcissist to be warm and loving and connected, if you can pair those two things, you have the best chance of success.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you that if we take the other category of someone that's clearly beyond help, what do? But I'm guessing you're going to say get out, right?
Yeah. If you are dating or in a relationship with somebody who's full-blown NPD, I would suggest getting out as soon as you can. And if you can, because it's very hard to change anyone. It's very hard to change ourselves. You're not going to change a full-blown narcissist. Even the best psychiatrist on earth is going to have trouble doing that.
That's a good point. I guess then that the real challenge here is knowing where someone is on that spectrum, right? It's like there's the people where you probably there's a lot you can do if the relationship's heavily invested, as you say, with kind of kids and, you know, home and, you know, all that stuff. On the other end, it's clear you just got to get out. But the trouble is, I suppose, particularly if someone is an optimist or someone is very compassionate and they're easily kind of they love that person, even how to know, yeah, which of those two categories that you're in.
It's very hard. Often you want to get support or advice from somebody you trust, you know, your family, your friends, the people who care about you. They can say, you know, Keith, you're in a bad relationship. You need to get out. But as all of us know who have had friends in bad relationships that we've tried to talk to, and as all of us know have been in terrible relationships with their friends saying you're an idiot, it's harder to do than it is to say.
Yeah. So in that instance, where does one start? Or indeed, if someone witnesses, you know, a close friend or a, you know, a sibling or whatever that's in a situation like that, how does one steer one towards, you know, dealing with that?
The one thing that's interesting with narcissism that I've seen is when you start talking to people about their partner and they go, well, yeah, he's kind of into looks. He's real look focused. And yeah, he's kind of antagonistic and he's a little bit materialistic. He's really into stuff and it talks about his hair a lot. And he's into his job and this and that. And you go, maybe think all those things are connected. And what happens sometimes is there's a click that goes, they go, oh my God, I never put it all together. All the time. I never put all these things together. Why does this person do all these? It's kind of narcissistic. It's an overall pattern. So sometimes just seeing it that way can be really useful because it helps you make sense of it. You might not want to go to your partner and say, look what I figured out. You're a narcissist. But at least for yourself, you see what's going on. So I think sometimes that first step of just looking at the patterns and start seeing if they tell the same story is really useful.
Very interesting. Yeah. And I guess also kind of implicit in what you're saying as well is having that empathy and compassion for someone that is in that dynamic, right? And it's very easy to I like what you said, that I haven't quite the exact words, but it looks easier than it is, in a sense, when someone's in that situation and being, I guess, patient and empathic and waiting for that person perhaps to get the clarity that they need.
Yeah, because it's you know, people, when they get into relationships with narcissists, whether it's the dating or it's dating or voting or fans or anything, these can be very powerful. And it's very hard. It's almost like hypnosis. It's just hard to get people out of it. So like you're saying, is be there and understand it's going to take this person a while to wake up. And being there for them is a good thing. The problem I've seen is when people just beat their friends up over and over and lose a relationship because their friend's so stupid. Like, well, give your friend a chance. I promise they're not the only idiot out there that's gotten a bad relationship with a narcissist. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it happens all the time because narcissists are attractive. I mean, it happens because it works, you know? Yeah,
right.
You know, you meet the people who are nice and shy are kind of not as attractive.
Yeah.
They're great to have relationships with, but they're not so good to start relationships with. Narcissists are great for starting relationships. They're just terrible for being. So have some compassion.
Yeah, that's great. Keith, the people that want to find out more about you and your work, tell us the best way to do that and what they can find.
Probably easiest way is wkeithcampbell.com. You can just put Keith Campbell narcissism into Google and you can find a whole lot of stuff. I did a little TED-Ed video. It's about 2 minutes long. It's probably the best thing I ever did. Thanks to those top illustrators over there that explains narcissism better than I can, but you can also listen to 3-hour podcasts, whatever you feel like.
Fantastic. And you've also got a couple of books out on the subject.
As well. Oh yeah. New Science of Narcissism. I'm so bad at plugging books. Yeah. The New Science of Narcissism just came up. I think that's a good one. Narcissism Epidemic, if you're interested in cultural change.
Fantastic. Keith, it's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed this. I think for a lot of people, there's going to be a lot of light bulbs that have been going off. So thank you so much.
Good. Thanks, Alex. I appreciate it too.